I'm Afshin Ratansi. Welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world. From the UAE, a week since Trump's Vice President J.D. Vance trudged to Switzerland to capitulate defeat in the Trump-Netanyahu war in Iran as he met with Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. All that before Trump signed the surrender in Versailles, where another treaty was signed yesterday, back in 1919. And all this as Israel continues to violate the so-called Memorandum of Understanding, continuing slaughter of civilians in Lebanon, Gaza, and the West Bank. The other nations of NATO, which didn't openly take part in the war in Iran, meanwhile, continue to pour their people's money into the war on Russia through Ukraine. As for beleaguered Trump, he's left to defend himself from the algae of the White House reflecting pool and the World Cup. The political careers of both him and Netanyahu are seen by some as over, ahead of midterms in the USA and quasi-elections on occupied land in October. Joining me again from Washington, D.C. is one of the world's greatest journalists. He's editor-in-chief of The Gray Zone, who co-produced and featured in the recent documentary Uncaptured, Jews in the Islamic Republic of Iran. He's the best-selling author of The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza, and The Management of Savagery, Max Blumenthal. Max, thanks so much for coming back on Going Underground. Let's get straight to the outgoing chief of Mossad, David Barnea. He said, regardless of the MOU, Israel will destroy Iran's governance. I'm not sure, destroy Iran's civilization. How can we expect his successor, Roman Goffman, to sabotage this memorandum of understanding?
Well, Roman Goffman has pledged to hone the Iran, various Iran cells that the Mossad set up, that Barnea set up in the Mossad, and to build on what Barnea managed to do, which is was a complete failure and one of actually the biggest botched intelligence operations of the year, if not in the last several years, which is to have Kurdish proxies who were poorly trained, poorly organized, Kurdish groups backed by the U.S. like Komale and PJAC to invade Iran under U.S. air cover and then instigate a mass uprising in which Iran would come apart at its ethnic seams. It was an absurd proposal. I remember it being announced basically through CNN, and it went nowhere. I mean, these Kurdish groups can't advance. And they can't do anything without U.S. firepower, and U.S. firepower itself proved to be extremely brittle and susceptible to Iran's anti-aircraft ambush systems. So I don't know what they're going to try to do except more of the same, which begins with sponsoring regime change rioters. But how can they communicate with one another if they don't have Starlink? Naftali Bennett, who's leading the Israeli opposition, as a more genocidal opposition than Netanyahu has been as leader, complained that Netanyahu had eliminated special intelligence programs to fund Starlink for potential regime change chaos agents. And he had been pushing for more and more Starlink. So the problem was that Iran obtained Russian technology to cut Starlink off. So I don't really hear any new ideas from them except
invade
that we
Turkey.
Do expect them to. That's next on the chopping block. But first, they have to get through Iran, and they haven't been able to do it. And the fact is, Israel cannot do anything without U.S. firepower, and the U.S. was not willing to commit the amount of men and materiel to do what Israel needed. They were completely unable to break Iran's deterrence, and they also proved susceptible to Iran's counterattack. So. What's going on with the Mossad is certainly they're learning some lessons there, and they are actually, Goffman, his rhetoric is all about justifying his bureaucratic priorities and his paycheck and getting money from the Israeli state and from us, their ultimate paymasters in the United States. It's not really about a real plan of action. And if there is anything they're going to do to unravel the MOU and the deal, it's going to be either targeting the resistance in the Lebanese population, the Shia population of Lebanon, because the Lebanon file, Iran refuses to close the Lebanon file. Lebanon is mentioned three times at the top of the MOU, so they're going to focus on Lebanon, continue to seek to escalate in Lebanon, and they're going to target us here in the United States, as we've seen through their various proxies, whether it's AIPAC or the influencers they pay or through some other more nefarious means.
Yeah, you mentioned the protests earlier on in what you just said. Everyone is saying, Trump was wrong to bomb Iran, but all the liberal media, so-called liberal media in NATO nations, were full of coverage of those protests, as if, as far as I understand it, the divide in Iran today is between those who support the Memorandum of Understanding and those who want a much tougher response to belligerents from NATO nations. But how do the NGOs like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the media themselves, how did they fertilize the field upon which this war grew?
I mean, were it not for the liberal NGO class and the Democratic Party, Operation Epic Fury, or what I call Epstein Fury, would not have been possible.
40,000 killed, by the way, is the figure that was widely reported by the Iranian government.
Well, I've seen it go up to 100,000. Soon, I imagine it could be at 6 million. But this all began on January 7th and 8th in Iran. There were some protests in marketplaces, which were soon exploited and transformed into violent regime change riots in which hundreds of police officers, unarmed Basij guards were killed. Many bystanders were killed. Many mosques were openly bombed and set ablaze. Shia shrines across Iran, entire government buildings were burned, police stations. And all along, the liberal NGO class from the human rights industrial complex of Human Rights Watch, which is basically George Soros's pet project, or Amnesty International, were declaring that tens of thousands were being slaughtered and pushing the responsibility to protect doctrine, essentially calling for some kind of military response. Amnesty International held protests in Europe calling for some kind of intervention or at least harsher sanctions. This is what helped the Guardian and this shady character, Deepa Parent, who we exposed as a former Indian fashion blogger who had never been to Iran, did not speak Farsi, was pushing the number of 40,000, which was a hoax number, 40,000 dead, concocted by monarchist elements close to the crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, the self-proclaimed crown prince. And so they were pushing the same responsibility to protect narrative that we've seen going back to Yugoslavia. And they did not expect a war. I was saying all along that this was being guided by outside powerful foreign intelligence forces, including the Mossad. And the Mossad has since confirmed that they were actively on the ground. Scott Bessent, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, has said that the U.S. manipulated Iranian currency in order to cause a currency crisis and fan the flames of these riots. But they ultimately failed. The Iranian government, the Islamic Republic, defended itself, and it saw the writing on the wall that this was a bridge between the 12-day war, June 2025, and Operation Epstein Fury, which began with the assassination, the murder of Iran's leadership, including its Ayatollah on February 28th. I was saying that all along. I was saying it in appearances on Piers Morgan, where I was set up sandwiched between five monarchist fanatics and a former Israeli war criminal. They set me up to sandbag me, but everything I said there proved right. And now we can look back at who was responsible for these phony numbers, for this entire R2P narrative. It was the liberal NGO class. And then beyond that, Afshin, the Democrats, the Biden administration set the stage for this when they supported Israel's escalation in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, in October 2024, when they could have been pushing a ceasefire in Gaza. Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, and the envoy to Lebanon, who was actually born in Israel and served in the IDF, Amos Hochstein, loved what Israel was doing to Hezbollah so much at that time that they did not push for a ceasefire. And this is what led to the various True Promise operations, allowing Israel to continue to escalate and funding it, providing it with all the bombs it needed. Amos Hochstein, more recently, in an interview, I believe, with CNN this March, declared that actually the Biden administration was preparing to support an assault on Iran, but their problem was only with Trump's execution of the attack, the clumsy execution, not the attack itself.
Yeah, well, we'll get to the need for a third party in your country in a moment, perhaps. But you were in Iran shortly before these wars began. And would it be true to say that it's not just the powerful Iranian military, but it's the forces of capital themselves that actually trump what you've called the Zionist logic? Ultimately, the effect of what Iran was doing was hurting capitalism. And that was that's the real choke point for any movement like Zionism that seeks to suppress human rights and human values.
Yeah, I mean, right now, Brent crude's at $75 a barrel. It's the dip. $75 should not be the dip. But yeah, if you're watching now, you probably want to buy the dip because we're right now in the midst of an unprecedented energy shock. I'm not a financial expert or financial genius. I'm not exactly breaking the bank here, but I think I can see the writing on the wall, which is that the MOU will fail for a variety of reasons. And I don't see the Strait of Hormuz necessarily coming open. Iran can always also go ahead and close the Bab al-Mandeb, which would massively affect international commodities and
energy
prices. So
what, because the United States isn't powerful enough to take on the Israel lobby? I mean, surely there's a chance of peace. And Netanyahu could realize he's beaten.
I mean, it's the brass tacks. We have a fake sort of inverted totalitarian system called oligarchy in the United States, which the Israel lobby is easily able to exploit. It exploits all these openings because campaign finance in the U.S. is unregulated, so they can spend $30 million or $23 million against a single member of Congress in a sparsely populated suburban and rural district in Kentucky, referring to Thomas Massie. What they can't get open is the Strait of Hormuz because Iran's deterrence doctrine is wise. And they had prepared for this for decades with fast boats, with mobile mines, with drones, very cheap drones. Of course, we know about Iran's ballistic missiles, but they understood that the U.S. could destroy its conventional navy and that they could still prevent shipping from getting through. And so the U.S. and Israel had not prepared for that. In fact, the Trump administration fired the top Iran expert at the National Security Council because Laura Loomer, the demented MAGA influencer, described him as disloyal to Donald Trump. He was the senior most figure in the NSC warning that if Iran were attacked, the first thing it would do is close the Strait of Hormuz. So now the Zionist movement and lobby that is responsible for this war through think tanks, like the Foundation for the Destruction of Democracies, I mean, the Defense of Democracies, they are running up against the hard rocks of reality. And it's a cold, hard reality that the capitalist class actually can perceive and which the working class experiences through staggering gas prices, which make it hard for them to get to work or drive their Ubers. And the only group in the world that exists outside this reality are Zionists who are willing to see more schoolgirls slaughtered and to send the global economy spiraling and to cause an energy shock like we haven't seen for decades in order to defend their psychotic little apartheid project in occupied Palestine.
Max Blumenthal, I'll stop you there. More from the editor of The Gray Zone after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the editor of The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal. Max, at the end of part one, you were implying the power of America's working classes, actually, in terms of their power over the Zionist project and the Israel lobby, because they found inflation intolerable because of the Strait of Hormuz. Are we going to see a resurgent American working class as another side effect of this Epstein war?
I think we're more likely to see more repression of dissident movements in the United States, that's what this 100-year sentence for anarchists who attempted some havoc outside an ICE facility in Texas signals. That's what the Department of Homeland Security's designation of anti-capitalists as terrorists signals. The entire invocation of the term narco-terrorist to imply anyone in across the Americas who opposes U.S. hegemony really is an indication of the fear within the Trump administration of the stock price of Palantir. Palantir's entire business model is based on a society in which large swaths of the population become restive, become sort of like Palestinians, and Palantir applies a sophisticated Israeli solution writ large to the global population, selling that to any government. Most recent buyer would have been Keir Starmer's UK, will provide them with solutions. So there's a deep fear right now. Right now, the U.S. public is not in the streets. There's a sense of disgust with Donald Trump, which is another reason, by the way, why the MOU is likely to fail, is that Donald Trump is the salesman, and he's so widely hated that most Americans actually oppose it, even as they oppose the Iran war. But there aren't mass protests in the street. What you have is midterms coming up and public disgust with the way things are, which is why the Democrats are also pivoting. And there's public disgust. For the first time in my life, Israel's become a major issue in elections. And you see candidates across the country campaigning against AIPAC. They're afraid to go directly against Israel or to call for the dissolution of the apartheid system through sanctions and boycotts, or what I think would be another responsible move, which is a military intervention to save the genocide-stricken Palestinians of Gaza. But they're campaigning against AIPAC for the first time, and it's paying dividends, as we've seen in two major congressional primaries, three congressional primaries in New York. The AIPAC-sponsored chairman of the Hispanic Caucus was just defeated by an unknown figure who was recently at Columbia University. The heir to the Levi Strauss fortune, Dan Goldman, was just defeated by 30 points by a Jewish legislator, Brad Lander, who previously was a liberal Zionist, and now he's sort of taken up the mantle of non or anti-Zionism because it's in vogue. So this really shows the movement of parts of the American public, particularly those who are more politically engaged, politically educated, like those in, moving into Brooklyn and Queens with, higher educational degrees. And it's actually shaking the establishment, and the Zionist movement and its lobbying tentacles are in panic mode because they don't have any soft power left. All they have to apply is bombing, censorship, and criminalizing those who oppose them, who increasingly are speaking to the hearts and minds of the American public in a bipartisan fashion.
Yeah, I mean, even Trump was funded, of course, by Miriam Adelson, maybe $200 million, but his biggest donors are Elon Musk and Timothy Mellon. I mean, why does he have to do what Miriam Adelson tells him to do? Anyway, Adelson, in her paper, Israel Ayoum, of course, infamously, there's an article there telling him what a failure Trump is.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't by Miriam Adelson, but it was by one of her proxies, and she's sending a message there. Miriam Adelson has a lot of proxies in Congress, too, and she's helped sponsor the career of Marco Rubio, as Donald Trump once famously observed before Donald Trump was sponsored by Miriam Adelson. There's a lot of leverage. And I also think there are psychological components that we might not understand to the sway that Israel has held over Donald Trump, although the spell appears to be breaking because Donald Trump saw their ultimate plan play out at his expense. And now he feels used and he can't find an exit ramp. And he may be so, I mean, he should be the salesman of the MOU, but he's become so unpopular as the result of this failed war that he's had to send J.D. Vance, his likely successor, out to either pay the cost of the failure of the MOU or to reap the benefits. And right now, I'd say it's actually a pretty good moment for J.D. Vance because the American public wants this war to end. They just don't want Trump to be the
one. Having said that,
end.
I mean, I know Ari Ben-Menashe was on this show the other day, the source of Cy Hirsch's The Samson Option, and said that Trump's life is in danger. Perhaps I should have asked him whether it's actually J.D. Vance's life that is more in danger. Trump isn't important enough to kill.
Well, we saw the, what was his name, Ben Sabti, the former Persian spokesman for the IDF, declare that America needs a new Pearl Harbor to understand what the stakes are. This is in response to J.D. Vance, gallivanting around the globe, negotiating via Pakistan with Iran. We can kind of get a sense of how Israel and the Zionist movement will respond with its back against the wall. And it's very disturbing. I've written extensively about how assassination plots were actually used and exploited by Israeli intelligence and Israeli cutouts in Trump's inner circle to push Donald Trump to the final decision to authorize Operation Epic Fury on February 28th. There were a series of plots partly cooked up by the FBI. One figure I refer to is a Pakistani national named Asif Mershant, who was accused of seeking to assassinate Trump on behalf of the IRGC. And Trump believed that these plots were real. There was also an attempt to spin the assassination attempt at Butler, Pennsylvania, during the height of Donald Trump's comeback campaign as an Iranian plot. And the key figure attempting to convince Trump that Iran had directed this sort of lone wolf figure, Thomas Matthew Crooks, to kill him, who was from the area, was Mike Waltz, who was a member of Congress, who was on the commission to investigate Butler, whose entire career had been funded by figures like Miriam Adelson, who's now technically the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., but his main job is to defend Israel. So imagine just for a second if Thomas Matthew Crooks had actually scored a hit on Donald Trump as Secret Service agents basically stood by before a local heroic Butler police officer first took him down or got him off his mark. Imagine what would have happened. You had Mike Waltz and Benjamin Netanyahu himself explicitly pushing the idea that Iran was behind this plot to kill Donald Trump. And you had Nikki Haley, who is now at an endowed fellowship, endowed by a longtime Zionist lobbyist who was a tool of the Israel lobby, waiting in the wings. Nikki Haley comes in, blames Butler on Iran, and pushes for a war with Iran at that moment as Netanyahu is agitating for
the war. Except that, of course, it would have been J.D. Vance that took over, that perhaps would have taken over. Although Butler was before. Anyway, Candace Owen has been talking a lot about all of this, especially about Butler. What are the prospects of a third party with the likes of this new MAGA base, Friends of Charlie Kirk, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owen, Megyn Kelly? Is there a third party going to be created now?
Well, Tucker Carlson has now said that he's leaving the Republican Party. He said this recently in a podcast interview. I don't know what that means. I haven't really been able to ask him what it means. And any third party started by Tucker Carlson will necessarily kneecap the Republican successor to Donald Trump, who would presumably be J.D. Vance, because I don't think the Republican base will support a Latino in Marco Rubio, someone who is responsible for TPS legislation, which helped allow many migrants to gain residency in the U.S. So it's probably, I mean, you would assume it's J.D. Vance. Tucker Carlson will not go against J.D. Vance. They've been friendly for many years. Tucker's son worked under J.D. Vance until he was pushed out by the Israel lobby. But this gives Tucker a lot of leverage over J.D. Vance, and it provides a threat if Vance is not the restrainer that he's portrayed himself as on future U.S. wars, and this includes Ukraine. Then you have Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massey, two of the most credible figures pushed out of the Republican Party who have a lot of cachet among the conservative base who could potentially join this kind of coalition. So I think there's a real credible threat there. And meanwhile, on the left, what you have is the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, making themselves a faction within the Democratic Party with no credible threat from the outside, and the Green Party basically being denied ballot access through the anti-democratic legal mechanisms instituted by the so-called Democratic Party.
Well, we're definitely going to have you on as these new alignments continue. Just finally, do you think Trump is going to pivot to Ukraine? I know his daughter was in the news because she was causing anti-American fury in Albania over an island. But is Trump going to pivot to Russia and in a way that the neocons would like?
Donald Trump needs a win right now, so he might pivot to Cuba. Donald Trump pivoting to Russia would be disastrous and would increase the chances.
I mean, pivoting could mean he's pro-peace as well, not just pro the dictator Zelensky, as he's called him.
Yeah, no, either way, it would be disastrous for Donald Trump because it would place him in another, if he pivots towards peace, it places him on a collision course with the national security state that is addicted to this war and that believes it's successful through the attack, the drone attacks that we've seen on Moscow's petroleum infrastructure, strikes deep inside Russia, not only in Belgorod and kind of border areas, but inside Moscow. And they're learning lessons. They're using this war as a laboratory for the perfection of drone warfare and asymmetrical warfare. They're also, this war has become profitable.
So you're saying he won't get the peace deal. Will Russia seek to end it much quicker, do you think? I don't know if you were advising the Russian government whether there was a better way of ending this conflict as it drags on.
I think, you know, because of Trump's failure and his betrayal of this campaign promise, which I think led, you know, a not insignificant number of people who wouldn't have voted for Trump to vote for him, there's an increasing chance of a NATO state, probably in the Baltics, which has been used as a staging base for attacks on Russia, including attacks on Russian critical infrastructure, to be attacked as a result of this.
Max Blumenthal, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Afshin.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to all those of you bereaved or affected by today's NATO nation wars of aggression. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new show. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.